This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
to Diamond Radio in the AM. Today is Tuesday, June 21st, and it's a little after 11 a.m. in the morning. And once again, this is C.A. Nuri. I do apologize for the late start. We had some technical difficulties, and I'm hoping that everybody can hear me. Today, I have my special guest, Luby Georges. Luby, if you can hear me, kindly say that you're there.
Hey, morning, C.A. Nuri. Good morning, Bahamas, and good morning to the wider universe. For those that are listening over the World Wide Web, yes, Nuri, I'm here. Let me know if you can hear me clear also.
Hello, and welcome once again.
Good morning
to Guided
Radio. I do apologize for the late start.
Today is Tuesday, June 21st. And it's a little after 11 a.m. in the morning. And once again, this is C.A. Nuri, and I shall be your host for today's show. Today, I'm privileged to have one, Luby Georges, as my guest. As we prepare to have a discussion about the United Nations Refugee Day, and I happened to buck Luby Georges yesterday, as they had a type of event at one of the movie places, and everything escapes me for right now. But Luby Georges, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. I do apologize for the late start. We had some technical difficulties, and like technology, thank God for your one's phone. So I'm on my phone, so bear with me as I try to conduct the show.
I'm also sitting in my mobile office, aka my car, and utilizing the phone.
Good. So let's start the conversation. What was yesterday's about? And I know you have some affiliation with the United Nations, if I'm not mistaken. And I want to understand exactly what is this Refugee Day, and what does that have to do with the Bahamas? You know.
Well, Yuri, yes, it was a pleasure running into you last night at the special event commemorating World Refugee Day 2022, hosted by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR, led by the sole person that we have working in the country, the Associate Protection Officer, Mr. Crispin Hall, who did a magnificent job in hosting the event, putting everything together, inviting dignitaries and also international counterparts, the persons in charge of UNHCR's operations for the Caribbean, and some folks also from the Washington, D.C. Office. I no longer am, tightly affiliated with the UN because of the office that I worked for, the agency that I worked for, kind of downsized, which was IOM, the International Organization for Migration. And yesterday, they were cited also for working with refugees and obviously all types of or every category of migrants, which refugees would be. And so, yeah, we worked very closely when I was with IOM. I was there for 2.5 years. We shared an office space, IOM, UNHCR, and also the office rep for the UN Resident Coordinator. And for those that don't know, the UN Resident Coordinator is the highest UN personnel for any region or any country. And our representative currently sits in Jamaica. And most of the UN agencies for the Caribbean or those that take care of issues or have auspices over issues in the Bahamas are based in Kingston, Jamaica, in fact. And so, yeah, we've been able to work together very closely over the past 2.5 years. We did not have jurisdiction directly, IOM, over the refugees that we have here in the Bahamas. But however, in the absence and times of travel and those sort of things, when Mr. Crispin Hall was not around, IOM, myself and others, we would always lend a hand to the refugees that would come to the office.
Okay, and you used the word refugees several times. I need to understand exactly what it is. But I know there's such a thing as political refugees and economic refugees, you know, and I want to know what's the difference and what type of refugees that we have here in the Bahamas.
Well, Nuri, the economic refugee, I think is something that we use and we utilize kind of loosely, but I don't. It doesn't necessarily fall underneath the definition of refugee, because if you Google the word, or if you go into the UN websites or other organizations' websites, you would see that a refugee is a person who's basically forced to leave their country in order to escape war, persecution, or natural disaster. And I say that to say this, or brought it up, and kind of want to nitpick at your economic refugee tidbit, because had that been a thing for us here in the Bahamas, maybe we would have seen Haitians added into the pool of refugees that we have in the Bahamas. But currently, well, up until the time that I left the United Nations here in the Bahamas, which was in January of this year, we had no Haitians as refugees in the Bahamas. They're simply migrants.
They're migrants. And the Haitians who migrate here would be termed migrants and not under refugees.
Yeah, and that is because they are fleeing the economic situation for the most part in Haiti, or they are seen as fleeing the economic situation in Haiti. You know, the economy is bad, you know, there's no jobs, and so they're seeking a better life and not necessarily running from persecution, you know, fear of losing their lives and that sort of thing. But mind you, with the recent spike of insecurities and gang violence, you know, kidnappings, all of these other things that have been happening in Haiti, at least for the past 2 years, I think maybe, you know, we may be able to kind of look at some of them a bit differently. But however, the process of applying and receiving that asylum status and becoming a refugee is not necessarily, you know, an easy one.
So before we go on with the process, can you give me a brief or loose definition of what is a refugee?
Well, I basically gave it already, you know, a person who was fleeing one's country, you know, fear of or to escape war, persecution, or natural disaster. You know, you fear that, you fear for your life, and you have good reason to leave your country, and you fear that if you remain in this country, which is my home country, that I may die, I may lose my life, I may be imprisoned or something of the sort. And so you would apply to some other country seeking asylum and asking to be relocated.
And as a member of the UN, what obligations does the Bahamas have? Do we automatically embrace those persons who are applying for asylum, or can you go in detail of the process?
Well, of course, the Bahamas, you know, being one of the UN members, being a signatory to the treaties or conventions. Also, for those that did not know, the Bahamas is kind of held in a higher standard than most countries around the world, because we sit, if I'm not mistaken, if our tenure is not over, but we had a 3-year stint that should still be going on, maybe up until this year, as the vice chair of the United Nations Human Rights Council. That is huge. That is big. And so we sit on that council as the second highest position. Imagine, you know, the world superpowers and the developed countries that we have out there and the UN members, the amount of countries, when you think UN, that are part of this organization. And for the Bahamas, I think we were the first ever small island developing state to be allowed or awarded the opportunity to sit in such a high chair. But, you know, the process, you know, the long and short of it is that persons would have to, obviously, as I know it from the Bahamas standpoint, apply to the Department of Immigration for asylum. And then, because we do have United Nations Human Rights, the High Commissioner of Refugees here locally, the Department of Immigration, on behalf of the Bahamian government, partners with or works very closely with the UNHCR to do the background checks and to do the necessary investigations and the interviews that are required, because, you know, seeking asylum and receiving that refugee status, you know, is not one that I think countries want to just throw around loosely and give out to any and everybody that just says, hey, you know, I want to seek asylum. And so there is a rigorous process. There are interviews. There are investigations that have to go on. And the UNHCR assists the Bahamian government on that. And then they would make, if depending on their findings, the UNHCR would make recommendations to the Bahamian government to grant refugee status to an individual. But it's still up to the Bahamian government to go forth with that and grant the status. I know that most countries, if not all, have a quota of refugees that they would accept on an annual basis or biannual basis. I don't know what the quota is for the Bahamas. It doesn't mean that countries will indeed meet that quota, but however, most countries have, you know, decided that they would be able to take on, you know, X amount of persons seeking asylum each year.
So right now I'm having a conversation with Louis Jardis, and he's basically going in detail about his experience working for the UN in particular. What section were you at again, Louis? Forgive me.
I was with the United Nations Migration Agency, which is the International Organization for Migration, IOM.
Okay, and I appreciate this conversation, and especially for this last minute type of thing. But in terms of the UN recommending to the Bahamas that this person deserves or should be granted asylum, what is the obligation or the services that the Bahamas government would render to someone who has been granted asylum?
Well, again, CA, I did not work directly in the refugees unit. That falls underneath UNHCR. But again, because we did share an office space, I did get to learn a little bit from my counterparts and my colleagues. I did get to interact and to see some of the services being rendered to the refugees that we have, and we have a few of them here in the country, you know, coming from all sorts of countries around the world. You know, people from Africa and people from Asia are here and have refugee status in the country.
So, you're saying that you do know some refugees from various places here in the Bahamas right now?
Oh, yeah, indeed. Yes, we do have. We have from various places, different continents, different regions of the globe. I've seen them myself. I've interacted with them myself on many occasions over the past 2.5 years at our office, especially when the UNHCR rep may not have been in office. And so the UNHCR, on behalf of the government, would render certain assistance, like food assistance. And so every week they would come over to the office, and each family or each refugee would receive a box or some package of food to take them throughout that particular week or 2 weeks. And then, you know, that cycle continues every week or every other week, which is very commendable. You know, during the pandemic, UNHCR, on behalf of the government again, or on behalf of themselves, ensured that those persons received, you know, items that we deemed essential, you know, the masks, the sanitizers, and they received those on a regular basis, or on an on-need basis, as-needed basis. I do believe that they also assist with rental assistance. And they may also assist them with, you know, finding a job, because, okay, the person has this legal status to reside and be here in the country. But oftentimes you would find that most of them do not speak English. And so, you know, you don't necessarily want them to be a burden on government, or UNHCR may have, you know, just limited funds. And so as best as they can, if they can find a job, then, you know, that would work out good for them. And so I believe they also assist them with trying to find a job. But, you know, rental assistance and the food assistance are two that I've seen happen over the years.
Okay, thank you very much for that. But I want to talk about your experience now working in your section. What a typical day, what would you have done in terms of that migration section?
Well, IOM is a very unique UN agency. I think the most unique UN agency in that it is project-based. And IOM did not have core funding like a UNHCR or an FAO or a, you know, UNESCO or some other branch. And so we, each IOM office around the world, the IOM Bahamas office, IOM Jamaica, IOM Haiti, IOM Venezuela, or IOM wherever, has to scan the landscape of the country, office, or where the country office is based, and to seek out, you know, gaps. And what we essentially did was write projects. And we would seek donors.
What do you mean by gaps?
Like, you know, civil society organizations. You know, if the government identifies migration management issues, well, that's an opportunity for a project. You know, I can tell you the last project I specifically worked on was a disaster risk reduction and preparedness project, which aimed to raise capacity in the migrant communities to respond to natural disasters, you know, and this would have came on the backdrop of Hurricane Dorian, of course, realizing that, you know, we have vulnerable communities. It is the reality. It's not a matter of trying to, say it's okay for persons to live in certain conditions or for persons to live in certain areas. That wasn't the conversation, you know, that's a conversation for another day. But however, the reality is that persons do reside in vulnerable areas, coastline areas, or in informal settlements, what we like to call shanty towns, you know, which are, you know, poorly constructed. And so should we have a natural disaster or some fire or some other catastrophic type of event, if the communities have a certain level of capacity to respond, then, you know, we think the communities would be in a better position up until maybe, you know, the professionals or the first responders can actually get to a particular area. And so we were working on such a project. And that project, you know, we had to sit down and we had to realize ourselves the vulnerabilities. That was a gap, you know, the capacity level to respond to emergency situations is a gap, as an example. And so we identified that and we wrote a project, we wrote a concept note, and then we pitched that to a donor. They liked the idea and they told us to go forth with, you know, writing out the project, and we wrote the project out. And then we sent that over, and thankfully we had two rounds of such a project. So that will be an example of, you know, finding gaps and that sort of stuff. And sometimes the government itself may say, you know what, we need some assistance in a particular area. And, you know, that actually goes a longer way, because then donors would more so or be more keen to buy in to the project, because the government would have already gave their stamp of approval for it.
Are you at liberty to say the status of the project in terms of what was implemented, in terms of it benefiting the migrant persons in the Bahamas now?
Well, up until the time that I left, that I was with IOM, again, and that would have been until January of this year, it would have been the second round of the project, which started. The first round was in 2021, just last year. And so at the end of the first project, which spanned, I think, January to about July, and then we started the other one in about November of last year, which was supposed to last up until, I think, this month, actually, June.
I want to know what basically you facilitated.
Up until that time, well, we facilitated trainings. We facilitated the distribution of NFIs, non-food items or essential items. And so what we did, for an example, we partnered with the fire department. We partnered with the Bahamas Psychological Association, for an example. And we brought them in and they did training sessions for civil society organizations that work directly with migrants. Right? And then we also had the civil society organizations work closely with their communities and to choose community leaders so that they would have formed for the lack of a better term, maybe, you know, a brigade or something to that effect, right? Persons whom we know or they know that they can call upon directly. Okay, we have these contacts within these communities to say, hey, you know, if something is happening, they can call the organizations also. And so they had the fire safety trainings as an example. And then at the end of the event, there was a distribution of non-food items such as fire extinguishers, some raincoats, fire alarms, fire, you know, smoke detectors, you know, first aid kits, and that sort of stuff.
So we are in the middle of a new hurricane season. We still have a huge migrant population who continue to be vulnerable. Are there any programs that will support that community now? Or is that community relatively safe in contrast to when Dorian passed?
Safe? Definitely not. You know, we were able to do what we were able to do with the limited amount of funding that we had. Obviously wanted to do more. And, you know, during my time with IOM and, you know, playing a major role in the writing of projects and obviously having to research to be able to properly put into context what needs to go into the proposal and then the fees and, you know, the execution of the project itself caused me to learn so much about climate change and the different vulnerabilities of communities and that sort of stuff. And because of that, I would, you know, challenge anyone any day and say that, no, the communities are not safe. We know that. And that's part of the reason why I myself also do not agree with, you know, the existence of shantytowns and wish that there could be a way for them to be done with. But however, there are some other realities that we would have to look at before we can get in that direction. You know, but that's a conversation for another day. But, you know, are the communities relatively safer now? Maybe 1% more than they were prior to us conducting the projects. Are there any organizations conducting such projects in the migrant communities? I would say right now, no, they're not. And so that is a huge gap. And it's just not the migrant communities, though CA. Right now, I sit as a part of the executive board, on the executive board for the official Camp Road Association. And as I, you know, roam and look around my community, Camp Road itself, we're vulnerable too. You know, I think Bayndown is vulnerable. I think Fox Hill is vulnerable. You know, there's just so many vulnerable areas in our country. Look at the flooding that we've been having in the past few weeks, just, you know, a day of rain. And then, you know, you can't go in certain areas that, you know, in times past, you were able to pass through those areas, but now it's changed. Everywhere is pine wood now, it seems, in Nassau. And so the entire community, the entire island, the entire country remains vulnerable. And I don't think that we have emphasized and worked enough since Dorian to prepare our communities, our different communities, to be able to respond to a natural disaster. And we've seen already the rain, the flooding, and we've heard that this should be a very active hurricane season. You know, we are too reactionary.
This is Guiding Radio AM. I'm speaking to Luby George. He's talking about his experiences as he worked with the IOM, with the United Nations. And he was talking about vulnerable communities and in section, the vulnerability of the entire Bahamas. We're about to take a break now. And when we come back, we will speak to Luby about solutions, recommendations in general. So we'll be right back.
We're not always able to see the storms in life approaching, but we can take the necessary steps to be prepared to ensure the safety of ourselves, our loved ones, and our property. This hurricane season, trust J.S. Johnson Insurance Agents and Brokers. We'll be here to help you get back on track in your time of need. Call 397-2100 or visit jsjohnson.com. J.S. Johnson Insurance Agents and Brokers, giving you peace of mind.
The new Guardian Radio app is here. Listen live to all our Guardian Radio shows and live video stream select programs in our studio. Get information about Guardian Radio shows and our hosts. Send messages, including text, email, and even call. All from our amazing new Guardian Radio app. Download it free today in your App Store for your Apple device or Play Store for your Android device. The all-new and improved Guardian Radio app.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Guardian Radio AM. This is C.A. Nuri, and I'm having with Luby Georges about his experience working for the UN. And before I ask him about solutions and ideas on what we can do to help the migrant community and the vulnerable communities throughout the Bahamas, I'd like to know, what is the IOM doing in regards to Haiti in terms of partnership with them, working with them to solve some of their issues?
Well, Nuri, again, earlier I mentioned that IOM is a project-based organization or an agency in the UN, and that's what kind of makes it more unique from all of the United Nations agencies. IOM has the ability, you know, I think their scope of work is actually endless. While they may be the migration agency of the United Nations, their scope of work is endless. You know, IOM has a health department, so they do some of the kinds of work that PAHO does. And so let's say PAHO is not present in a particular country, which I doubt, you know, PAHO is a huge organization, but nonetheless, I have the capability to do some of that work. It works in the kids area. It works in education and food and agriculture and, you know, development. So IOM, its scope of work is just endless, man. But again, because it is project-based or project-tied, each IOM office in each country has to, you know, develop projects for that specific country. But however, that does not mean that IOM offices cannot collaborate when there are common threats. So, for example, we have a migration management issue here in the Bahamas with Haitian migrants entering the country, you know, illegally and that sort of stuff, and coming from Haiti. So again, the IOM office in the Bahamas can collaborate with the IOM Haiti's office should the IOM Bahamas or Haiti come up with some project so that they can, you know, link it together. I've seen many projects and aware of projects where IOM Dominican Republic and I worked very closely together with, you know, border management type of projects and also assisted voluntary returns and reintegration projects in Haiti. And the AVRR ones, you know, I really like. And so what it does is it allows migrants in a particular jurisdiction. So let's say, for example, the Haitians that are living in the Bahamas, should some AVRR funds be available to IOM Haiti and IOM Bahamas, they can seek out Haitians or make it known that they have some funding and they can assist Haitians in the Bahamas who would like to voluntarily return. And so those persons would not be repatriated. They will not be deported. IOM, obviously the government would be aware and there's a role for them to play also in this, but those persons would voluntarily present themselves to IOM and they would go through, you know, a process, and then IOM would, you know, the plane tickets and all of that sort of stuff, and take those persons back to their home country. But what IOM doesn't support is, you know, increasing vulnerability, putting persons in further harm or decreasing someone's migrants' resilience. And so they want to improve the resilience of migrants, migrants' communities, and their home countries. And so the reintegration programs would assist them when they get back home with maybe setting up businesses and, you know, providing some, you know, funding for kids to possibly, you know, go to school. And so they would monitor that situation maybe over 6 years to a year, 6 months to a year, to ensure that those persons are on the right track and that the program is going the way that it should be going. And so the possibilities of IOM Bahamas and IOM Haiti collaborating, you know, it is there. But however, sadly and unfortunately, IOM Bahamas, as I understand, is on the verge of actually shutting down. They may be closing down in September, as I've heard from some reliable sources, but, you know, I hope it doesn't happen. Again, I'm no longer with IOM. I left IOM in January of this year. It was a mutual separation. There were some things that I wanted to do for myself and for my life. Venture off into business, being an entrepreneur and, you know, working for the UN or working for IOM would not have allowed me the flexibility to be able to do what I wanted to do.
But still, on the topic of hurricanes and vulnerabilities, and you mentioned Kemp Road, you mentioned Fox River, you mentioned Baintown, and these constituencies have issues and being vulnerable for the hurricanes. Did the IOM recommend a hurricane shelter of sorts or lobby for something similar to that? And give me some solutions you have that we should be doing in the Bahamas.
Most definitely with the, as it relates to hurricanes and hurricane shelters. About 2 years now, or a year and a half at the very least, IOM did, and anyone can Google it right now, IOM Bahamas Shelter Report. Just Google that and it should come up. It is a very extensive and detailed piece of document that IOM would have issued of a research and study that was done in Abaco and Grand Bahama and also in Nassau. And what IOM Bahamas did was, you know, there was some remaining funds that we had from the Hurricane Dorian emergency and recovery efforts type of thing. And so IOM decided to use some of that to bring in a few experts. I think one of them flew in from Germany and another one was from someplace in the United States. You know, we had some persons here who worked for IOM all over. These persons that have been dispersed all over in El Salvador, other places. But however, this study would have been done very extensive, very professional in Abaco, Grand Bahama, and Nassau. And as a result of that study, recommendations were made to the government. And there was a presentation of this to the government. When it was done, or when it, yeah, after it was done, for shelters on different islands, including Nassau, and the state of the shelters, also in the report itself, the shelters that we currently have, which are schools and churches, yeah, they're sound structures, but were they necessarily designed, you know, for you know, to allow proper shelter management or what we would call camp management. No, we saw after Hurricane Dorian, you know, the horrors, you know, the deficiencies in the way that we manage shelters or the way that we manage camps. You know, lots of lessons learned. Hopefully we are, you know, working, you know, towards fixing those with NEMA and social services, Department of Health, and all of the necessary stakeholders. But however, you know, there was a lot of, you know, deficiencies highlighted back then. But again, please Google that piece of document. It's very extensive, very detailed, very professional. And you would see that, you know, some recommendations were made for proper hurricane shelters to be built on certain islands. I see now that the government, through the DRA and the other disaster recovery management agency thing that we have, or MISH, are talking now about this major shelter that is to be built, I think, in Abaco. So kudos to the government. Hopefully the PLP administration can go forward and have that done. Sadly, I don't think that, you know, the last administration, the FNM administration, really bought into the proposal and the research that IOM and the work that IOM wanted to do in the Bahamas. And so we are where we are today. But however, we do need, you know, proper hurricane shelters to be built, and we must be proactive with that.
Good. I mentioned that the IOM assisted in the repatriation of migrants back to Haiti. What happens then, for example, if that did happen? Do you just leave them there or continue support?
IOM did not assist with any repatriation of any migrants in the Bahamas. In fact, IOM would not participate with the repatriation of migrants in any country. IOM would assist with volunteers based on the program that they have, which would assist the migrants in their home countries to be set up and raise their level of resilience. And you know, identifying the things or the reasons why they would have left their country in the first place and try to resolve those back there. And so repatriation is a, you know, is a government thing. IOM doesn't participate in that. What IOM could assist the government with as it relates to the repatriation or deportation process is maybe while persons are in detention to ensure that, you know, the persons, you know, receive due process. You know, maybe make phone calls on their behalf or, you know, seek out family members on their behalf. You know, maybe there's someone sitting at the detention center who's saying and claiming that, hey, I was born in the Bahamas, man. You know, just check my family. They have my birth certificate. Maybe the government doesn't have the resources or at the time to go about and, you know, find out if that's true or to go check out the family. And I will maybe be able to step in there. We also had a project, CA Nuri, where we did a documentation project assisting vulnerable Haitians in the Bahamas with their regularization process, regularizing their immigration status. And so it was not for anyone deemed irregular. It was for persons, for example, who may have lost documents or documents may have been damaged during Hurricane Dorian, or for persons born in the Bahamas who may be stuck and don't have the financial or technical needs to be able to go through and finalize their applications at the Department of Immigration.
Okay, moving away from the IOM and your time there, back to your social activism and advocacy, what is the Haitian, no, let me change the word, the Creole community doing in terms of preparing themselves for this hurricane season, and especially those who live in these compound environment?
Well, you know, I can only, to be quite honest, I can only speak to what I'm doing or, you know, the type of work that I've been affiliated with. There are a few organizations out there, sadly, most are very reactionary, you know, and the whole projects, raising awareness, teaching, education campaigns side of things, I don't, you know, necessarily think that most understand that that is as equally important as protecting the rights of persons when they are abused or, you know, something else happens. So, however, myself, you know, with the knowledge that I've been able to gain from working with the United Nations and from collaborating with other civil society organizations here in the Bahamas and internationally, I've been moving around. You know, I've had speaking engagements at different churches with different organizations and some communities being invited and, you know, trying to raise that awareness there. I've been using my social media platforms, you know, not to toot my own horn, but I do think that my Facebook page is the mostly followed Facebook page in the country for Haitians itself. And so I've tried to use that to, you know, gather information sometimes from NEMA, gather information from civil society organizations or from the international organizations, translate those, drop those on my Facebook in Creole or do a video or do something where as we try to help people to understand their vulnerabilities and some of the things that they should be doing in preparation for the hurricane season. But, you know, contrary to popular belief, people think, you know, some crazy people on the behavior side think that I'm not doing those things or we're not doing those things simply because they don't see it and they don't hear it. But if we do it in English, then how does the migrant community receive it? It has to be done in a language that they understand and that they can digest. And so most of my work in raising awareness, in teaching, in trying to inform the mind is done in their native language. And so I don't expect you, if you don't understand or speak Creole, to be able to understand or to see or to notice the work that is being done. And so people sometimes be like, oh, so why don't you tell them this? Why don't you tell them? Well, I do tell them this and that, but I just do it in Creole. You know, doing it in English. I mean, you do it in English every day, Dury. Everybody else does it in English every day. But, you know, with the level of understanding and of English, of the English language itself, that most may have, you know, it may be fruitless to just allow information to remain out there in English. During the pandemic, you know, I worked very closely with the Ministry of Health and the public hospitals authorities in ensuring that we translated, you know, essential messages. And so that, you know, during the pandemic, and we're still in the pandemic, but, you know, COVID messaging was getting out there to the migrant community. And that is a role that we can play. And so if the policies are there, if the regulations are there, strategies are there, you know, we must ensure that everyone is aware. And so I'm trying to do my part in that regard.
Okay, Luby, I still have 3 more minutes. And I want to, you to give some commentary about the coal, the pine tree forest, and the accusations that the Creole community is responsible for harvesting coal from these pine forests.
Man, you know, you may have to do a whole show on that one.
I'll invite you back to do a whole show.
I see.
I hear you all exporting the coal.
Anytime you're ready. Complete lie. You know, that man, in my opinion, you know, has an agenda. There's something got to be wrong. I mean, the passion may be there, but the strategies in which the persons leading this charge are utilizing is very questionable, to say the very least. You know, it's not getting us anywhere or in any. They've highlighted some issues, but the strategy that they're using is very distasteful, in my opinion. They're lying. And they're sowing more seeds of discord and division between Haitians and Bahamians. And I think based on their agenda, they went for the low-hanging fruit because nothing else was working out for them. You know, you couldn't win or you couldn't be a part of any other political parties. You form your own political party, you can't win there. You know, so they went for the low-hanging fruit. You know, if you talk about gays or you talk about persons of the LGBT community or you talk about Haitians, those buzzwords, those buzz phrases, those vulnerable communities, you mention them, and then you know that you're going to have a contingency of support automatically flowing your way. And so I think that is what's going on. And so for those persons to, in the first instance, when this whole entire thing started, to admit on video and audio and everything else that they went out there and they cleared down acres of pine forest, and then now when the attention is shifted on them, And it's time for them legal and wrong acts and the laws that they've broken, they decided now to switch it on the Haitians, or the Haitians are cutting down the trees. The Haitians are exporting the coal. It is a multi-million dollar industry. All blatant lies. And I challenge them any day to prove that coal is being exported from the Bahamas to Haiti by Haitians. I guarantee you they cannot prove that. It is a lie. Why do that?
You know, well, I would end with that.
And how do you, the Bahamian, just choose? Yeah, I challenge them to prove what they've been saying. Lie.
I enjoyed having this conversation with you, Luby Georges. Thanks very much for joining me. I know it's very last minute, and I thank you for joining me for that. This has been Guardian Radio and AM. My name is C.A. Nuri, and have a beautiful and blessed day.